Pleasure to introduce the next speaker, Kennedy Graham. Kennedy attended universities in Auckland, Wellington and Boston with a BCom in Economics and Accounting, BA in Political Science and an MA and PhD in International Relations. For some time, Kennedy Graham was a New Zealand diplomat involved in the negotiation of the South Pacific Nuclear Free Zone. He worked as Secretary General of Parliamentarians for Global Action. So even then, his mind was thinking about these issues a long time ago. He's worked for the United Nations, first as a director of the United Nations University from 1999 to 2004, and later as senior consultant in the Department of Political Affairs. However, one day, while he was sitting in the United Nations thinking about life, he joined the Green Party and took the step onto the political stage. As he said, "I was prepared to climb the building from the outside," he says of his desire to make a difference, and that's a very brave thing to do. Kennedy Graham's professional approach has usually been to test the prevailing orthodoxy and associated rules of engagement. I hope you've heard some of his things. This is his third term in Parliament as a List MP for the Green Party, and he has been making waves for all of that time. His address to us sits very well after Lloyd Gehring's address and Jim Rahman. He's talking about confronting our souls to save our hides, a global perspective on an uncertain future. Would you welcome Kennedy Graham?
Kia ora tātou. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here and for the introduction. I have just one other thing, or two other things, perhaps. Recently, we've established a research centre, New Zealand Centre for Global Studies, resplendent on Waiheke Island, to which you're all invited to come from time to time. And others who are invited include the 5.5 grandchildren that I now have, at least the 5 at the moment. So thanks again. And let me also commence by seizing the opportunity which I really have to pay tribute to Professor Lloyd Gehring, whose moral integrity and intellectual brilliance I think is probably without peer in this country. Now, I have prepared on the plane to New York and back a fairly lengthy article along the lines of the subject, headed Confronting Our Souls to Save Our Hides. It's the heading that came to me on the plane, because it struck me that that is probably how we would sum up the situation we find ourselves in now. And if it is Mokorba and Cassandra, and which is, of course, binary choice, and it's probably a gradation, so if it's somewhere between the two, and then the question is who, if anybody, or we could break ourselves down to an infinitesimal or an infinite number of infinitesimal pieces, then it's somewhere along the spectrum there that we need to be to confront an uncertain future, because uncertainty is now the name of the game. If we thought 100,000 generations back that things outside the cave entrance were uncertain, it's nothing like what we ponder and contemplate now, I think. But in a different way. And that in itself heightens the uncertainty. But I learned only 10 minutes ago that you haven't read the paper. So therefore it's tempting to read it to you. It's a temptation that I will resist. for 1,000 reasons, none of which I'll explain, none of which I need to. What I thought I would do is read the introductory paragraph so that I can hurtle off out of the train station along the right tracks. And then, to mix my metaphors, when I take flight, I'll just wing it into the rest of the paper. And we will find out in retrospect how accurately I was adhering to it in the navigational compass of that flight. I divide the paper into essentially six sections. Dimensions of uncertainty. Uncertainty in the planet. Uncertainty in the species. Uncertainty in the cosmos. And then, of course, confronting our souls and saving our hides. So I just want to read the first few paragraphs on dimensions of uncertainty, because I think that's quite critical in understanding how we, as individual humans, as a nation, if you like, and as a species, and that's the elephant, so to speak, in the room, having spent time at the UN. I know a few elephants. And how we, as a species, should be handling the future. So the section on dimensions of uncertainty reads like this. There are different dimensions to uncertainty. There is anthropocentric uncertainty. Humans cannot predict the future, and so it is forever uncertain. World War I came as a surprise. So did the Munich Olympics, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, 9/11, the first Fiji coup, and the Waihini disaster. This gives rise to a cave-like fear from which we protect ourselves through societal bonding and technological wizardry. Primal fear could be tamed, or at least befriended. We came to terms with it, enveloping our local fears in the bosom of a cosmic security, an abiding assumption that all was well with the cosmos and our planetary home. During the Pleistocene, Homo sapiens retreated from the ice, but we were not afraid. It was simply the forces of nature to which we were responding. Thereafter, our sense of cosmic security was at its highest throughout the Holocene, 10,000 years of warm and stable climate. All of that has come to an end. It took three quick centuries for modern science, from Copernicus to the current classical model, to show that not all is as it seems. And in the fleeting span of a human lifetime, we now pause at the entrance of a new cosmic cave, peering out on dark matter, dark energy, and supersymmetry in search of a theory of everything. So now we have cosmic uncertainty. It is not primal, but existential. There is today a developing intellectual industry known as existential risk. The scientists conjured it up, the universities are packaging it, and the corporates and the military are taking it seriously. Cosmic uncertainty takes three forms. This is what I want to get across. There is new knowledge of the cosmos itself, spawning a new sense of infinite wonder. There is a dawning recognition that we are personally responsible for the degradation of our planet. And we are taking the identity and direction of our species in our own hands. The magnitude and impact of these developments are unprecedented, and they cannot be understated. So I'm going to just address each of those three and then finish with the conclusions that I come to. So uncertainty in the planet, and then address the uncertainty of the species and uncertainty in the cosmos. And I start with the planet because it is the more traditional pursuit. It's more amenable to established analysis. and it has been my field. So what is the uncertainty when it comes to us and the planet? When I was in my formative years at university here and then in Boston, and then in foreign affairs in the 70s and 80s, the world was a comprehensible place, a tough place, but it was comprehensible. We had, since 1945, since 1920, updated, 25 years later, in 1945, we had the beginning of the existence of international law and international institutions by which we were going to tame atavistic power. And we embarked on that with purpose and resolve. And I dare say we have not dropped that, but we immediately tripped over the continuing existence of the primal forces of atavistic power, which we knew, when the ink was drying, were there. But this was our attempt, our second or our first revised attempt, to tame it. 70 years later, we are now literally this week, last week, this week, next week, celebrating, if that's the word, the 70th anniversary of the UN in New York. And we look back over 7 decades and we ask ourselves, what have we achieved? And again, you can engage in Micawber and Cassandra-like analysis of that. But the characterizing feature of all this is change, especially since 1990. One of the biggest dimensions is the number of players, if we're talking about the United Nations. When it kicked off in 1920, there were 42. In 1945, revised attempt, there were 51. Today, assembled there in New York this week, 193. That is not an optimal number for effective decision making. And when one of the members is more than 200,000 times larger than the other, the smallest, that is not the most credible way of imparting authority. How can we expect the global town hall to have legitimacy and credibility when it is, its configuration is dysfunctional to the point of absurdity? Efforts at reform, however, whether it is in the United Nations, other than the General Assembly, or more particularly the Security Council, unleashes a new wave of orgiastic writhing on the part of all of us, from the permanent five who dig in to defend their 19th century style national interests, to the new aspirants who rationalize permanent membership for themselves on the basis of representation and legitimacy to the global community, but who then demand precisely the same 19th century conditions if they get there, to envy on the part of the rivals to the rivals, regional hegemonic power number one, regional hegemonic power number two, and then a general feeling of bordering on helplessness on the rest of us, the other 160. In watching it, it is not rocket science. It is not difficult to identify intellectually solutions to these things. That is not the cave entrance. The cave entrance is the political dimension of sowing the seeds of consensus to get there, especially in times of apparent normalcy, because history has bequeathed us the lessons that we only basically pick up and rewrite the rule book after the latest cataclysm to prevent its recurrence, as opposed to summoning and displaying sufficient foresight and resolve to do it in a proactive way instead of reactive before the cataclysm. And I dare say, at the risk of being Cassandra, which is not my natural position, that our current times bear an eerie resemblance to the Edwardian era. Our current early 20th century situation, in my view, is most pithily and accurately summed up in Al Gore's not latest book, penultimate book, called The Future. It has two parts, or two substantive parts. The first is headed Earth, Inc., and the second is headed Global Mind. And I think if you run those together, you have the 21st century, where governments pretty much around the world have either come to terms with or invited in or ceded to the corporates, which then, in the pursuit of perfect competition and freedom of enterprise, exploit the natural resources of the planet and dispose of the waste to an excessive degree, largely untrammeled, at least unconstrained. Earth, Inc. And on the other hand, you have the early growth since the early 90s. I was involved in New York in the early 90s in that kind of context of the global civil society, NGOs, research institutes, religious movements, all gathering together, independently and together, at the United Nations and elsewhere, with a view to seeking remedial measures to Earth, Inc. But they are no match in resources. They are in commitment, but not in resources. The United Nations reaches out to them tentatively, and the Bretton Woods sisters, the IMF, the World Bank, WTO, bless the corporates, keep the United Nations at arm's length, and largely ignores the civil society to date. There is a need to change in this respect. There is a new degree of collaboration, if it's probably overstating it, between the United Nations system and the Bretton Woods system. But one of the tragedies of the last 70 years, or shortcomings, is the standoff between what are essentially two different dimensions of what's meant to be a global institutional system. There is another way of approaching the institutional dimension of this as well. When we look at the three branches of government, I just came from a conference yesterday in Parliament in Wellington called Modernising Parliament. and now I'm going. Enough just to say that of the three branches of government, with separation of powers, we need to increasingly transfer those presumptions, those principles, to the global level, so that the global community of peoples can actually have some meaning in working through the international community of states. Because if you look at the United Nations Charter, it starts in the name of we the peoples, but immediately cedes, delegates operational responsibility to the representative governments. So it is the executive branch of government, almost exclusively, that operates, certainly through the United Nations in the sense of the General Assembly and the Security Council and the Economic and Social Council. What of the judiciary? Well, it exists inside the United Nations system. The International Court of Justice, we call it the World Court. It's a misnomer. Its real name is the International Court of Justice. International because the major powers don't bother with it much. Reserving, making reservations against any litigious charges against them. Nicaragua? China won't have anything to do with it much. Russia. France and UK, at least to their credit, take the ICJ seriously and engage in it. But it's really on the periphery, the International Court of Justice, even though it's part of the United Nations system. The other dimension of international law, or the judiciary, is a much more recent phenomenon, the International Criminal Court, the ICC, in force since 2002, 13 years, meant to have come in 1948, 1951, there was a charter, statute, for the International Criminal Court, 1951, Cold War, put it in the freezer, brought it out in 1989 to thaw in the sun until 1998 when the Rome Statute was adopted, and the court came into effect in 2002. It is actually not strictly an integral part of the United Nations system. It is independent under the Rome Statute. It's a treaty body. But it has an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, with the United Nations and cooperates with it. And we could go down a rabbit hole about the relationship between the special between the prosecutor of the ICC and the Security Council, but we don't have time. The ICC isn't qualitatively different because unlike the ICJ, which takes simply civil cases, if you like, between states only, the ICC, International Criminal Court, deals with individuals only and is therefore a qualitative step forward. Personal view, ICC represents the biggest step forward in taming atavistic power since 1945. Leaders and armed military individuals, seniors, largely, are individually accountable in a criminal liability under international law for the first time. A prime minister. I had a member's bill. I will allow myself a 30-second diversion. I had a member's bill in 2009 in the House, which came out of the ballot, according to God's democratic dice, and it went in for a first reading. It would have made aggression, which is going to become the fourth crime under the International Criminal Court, probably in 2017. In 2009, I basically presumed it and put it into a bill, members' bill in New Zealand domestic law. With great respect to every Prime Minister of New Zealand who has ever lived and is currently living, it would put the Prime Minister, and let us hope, let me hope, it would be a Green Prime Minister one day, in jail for 10 years, up to 10 years, for violating the United Nations Charter and committing aggression by deploying its armed forces overseas in violation of the United Nations Charter, 10 years in jail. It had a first reading. It's worth reading the Hansard, August and September 2009. Do you know what the vote was? This is more than 30 seconds. The vote. We're talking about 122 members of Parliament on a bill that would potentially put the Prime Minister in jail for 10 years for deploying illegally armed forces overseas. 10 years in jail. 64-58. Labour supported, Māori Party supported, Greens. 64-48. It's going to come. Aggression is going to become an international leadership crime. Probably in 2017. When that happens, personal view, humanity is going to turn a corner. Nobody likes 10 years in jail. And what about the legislature at the global level? There is none inside the UN system. There is this august body in Geneva, the Interparliamentary Union, going since 1888, preceded the League of Nations, wanted nothing to do with the League of Nations and nothing to do with the United Nations until the 1990s, when they realised, to their shock and horror or awe, that Parliamentarians for Global Action in New York was getting a march on them in dealing with the United Nations in a very informal way. And the IPU suddenly signed a memorandum of understanding with the United Nations, and there is increasingly serious interaction between the IPU and the United Nations. Interparliamentary Union. 162 parliaments, members. I'm going to Geneva in 10 days' time to their next conference as a member of the New Zealand parliamentary delegation to the IPU. And I am a strong supporter of a closer relationship between the IPU and the UN to the point where they actually become integrated. There is a movement for a UN parliamentary assembly. It doesn't matter which route you go down into the uncertain future, as long as you go down it in the right direction. So IPU should become, within 5 to 25 years, let's say, the UN Parliamentary Assembly, perhaps. But these, all of this is to say that we need to strengthen our institutions more than our law. The international law is stronger than we think. It's just that it doesn't have the enforcement power. And we need that. Why should we worry about this if and when our primary instinct is to keep power at bay over us as individuals for the sake of individual freedom? Why should we worry? We should worry only to the extent that our capacity to do anything, for good or for bad, to wreak destruction and degradation on the planet, is at a scale greater than our legal and institutional capacity to handle it. So in tackling the global problems, we have only international capacity. That is an imbalanced equation. And we are at that stage now, where we are free riding on the global commons in the name of national interest. And we are allowing ourselves national freedoms times 193. It's the best example is the climate change, climate issue, where I have been attending UN conferences in 1992 and Copenhagen, the failure in 2008, 2009, and then most recently in heading to Paris in a few months, where we are addressing a demonstrably global commons problem, but we think we can get a solution by pursuing national interests times 196, it is, because there are three extra parties, most of whom go to Copenhagen, Cancun, Durban, Doha, Warsaw, and now Paris, and come home, as they do in our country, into the parliament, and then say, well, we didn't quite get to save the planet in terms of 2 degrees, but hey, look at it, it's half full. And what's more, we punched above our weight. It's true. This is what is said in the parliament. Punching above your weight, which was fine for 19th century trade negotiations, punching above your weight for a 21st century solution to a global commons problem is a contradiction in terms. Times 196. 196 punches above your weight will not solve a global problem. It cannot be done logically. So we need a reframing, mental, emotional, spiritual reframing as individuals, as nations, as a species. If we're going to get there, we have to confront our souls. Is there a way through the eye of the needle? Well, it's Article 39, of course, of the United Nations Charter. Because you can either engage in revolution or wait for the next cataclysm and then rewrite it, or you can look to the existing legal and institutional capacity and see how can we creatively use what we have to solve these qualitatively new problems. Article 39 kind of does it. Article 39 simply says that the Security Council has the power or the responsibility to maintain international peace and security and prevent things. Three things: aggression, breach of the peace, threat to the peace. Two of those three are points of fact: aggression and breach of the peace. If it is so clear that there is an aggressor, you name it. It's happened twice in 70 years. You name an aggressor. So aggression. If the facts are a bit murky or the politics are a bit sensitive, you call it a breach of the peace. Still a point of fact. The third one is qualitatively different. It's over here. It's a threat to the peace. That is a subjective judgment. It is a generic, or can be, a generic issue as opposed to a specific fact. Since 1990, when the Security Council has been freed up, it is allowing itself greater latitude and empowerment to determine, subjectively if you like, 15 states, New Zealand's one now, on behalf of 193, as to what is a threat to the peace. So the question now can be, legitimately at the UN, what, if anything, what might be a threat to the peace? So it used to be interstate warfare, which has kind of actually fallen away more than we think. But it has increasingly become civil war, internal strife, terrorism, the spread of weapons of mass destruction. And all of those, more or less, are in the realm of military, however new and global, but also going beyond that and identifying epidemic global diseases and climate change, as perhaps they did with Ebola disease. They have not quite yet with climate change. I went to New York in July for the New Zealand Open debate in the Security Council on small island state security. I called on the government to get the Security Council across the line and declare climate change to be a threat to peace and security. New Zealand felt it couldn't do that on 30 July 2015. But the British and the Germans, since April 2007, have been trying. And the Security Council has got to the stage, inching along, of calling it a risk multiplier. And it is, and that's true, it is a risk multiplier. And it will be one more step only to call it a threat to peace. When that happens, the lever can get pulled for empowerment, binding powers. Resolution 1373, the Security Council orders 193 national parliaments to pass laws about terrorism, money laundering and terrorism. Resolution 1540, similar thing. National parliaments, the governments, member states will do the following on fissile material transfers. Resolution 2278, just last November, the same on foreign terrorist fighters for ISIL. Security Council as global legislator, de facto stepping into what should be a global legislature's job. This is the kind of peering into the future at the political and legal level that we have no choice but to confront. The Security Council will declare, I think, climate change to be a threat to peace and security sooner rather than later. Once the British, probably, or the French, take the presidency for the month, and China and Russia, and for that matter the United States, agree to go along, things will change. That's just, and if you follow the Security Council, you will see that it is with extraordinary irony over 70 years, it is the scientists now that are advising the diplomats and political leaders in the Security Council, not the generals. Joachim Schellnhuber, head of Potsdam Research Institute for Climate Change Impact, has briefed the Security Council and others. There used to be a military staff committee under the UN Charter. When I was a student in Boston and went to the UN as an intern back in the 70s, a young German student colleague and I gatecrashed the military staff committee just out of sheer youthful exuberance and interest. And we got about 10 meters into the room and were escorted out again. But I think we're the only two civilians ever to get into the military staff committee for 10 seconds. But it was defunct then. There were five generals, literally, sitting around agreeing on the next date of the next meeting. That's all it was. We, not to say we don't need the generals for good, constructive purposes of the legal and legitimate use of armed force for harmony and stability, but it is the scientists we are listening to now in terms of working out what is the direction forward. There's Schellnhuber, there's Johan Rockström, who heads up the Stockholm Resilience Center, because it's not just climate change. Climate change is one of nine planetary boundaries. We need to be, not just as individuals or research institute researchers, but as individuals, nations, and the species, thinking globally, not just in science, but translating that into politics, diplomacy, and law. So the nine planetary boundaries, of which climate change is only one, and three of which we are currently breaching. And if you look to what is the global governance on those nine, you'll find that three of the nine, we do have framework conventions of modest effect. Two or three others, we have soft law in the sense of UN declarations, and a couple of others, there is nothing. We actually, even the scientists are breaking new ground. They don't have the quantification metrics to know. They know that just that there are boundaries. So if we are in the era, the Anthropocene, and we're in the era of cosmic uncertainty, then we need, in legal and political terms, at the UN Security Council and elsewhere, in our national parliaments, at the IPU, to start thinking globally about the planetary boundaries, the imperative of sustainability. And the associated need to live harmoniously one with another, times 7.3 billion, whose ecological overshoot is now 50% after 10,000 years of the Holocene, and entering the Anthropocene, our ecological curve crossed somewhere around 1981 CE, where our ecological footprint exceeded the carrying capacity of Earth, according to the researchers, the ecological footprint metrics. 1981, it is now 50% overshoot, 34 years later. So, if you do the clinical number crunching, 7.3 million, 50% overshoot, means that current technology and current lifestyle would mean the carrying capacity of Earth is about just under 4.8 billion, not 7.3. We need, and that's not to say let's go around shooting cows and shooting ourselves, but what it will mean is that the demographic projections, which have us going to 10.2, personal view, is not going to happen. Unless you have Macaba, an extraordinary technological breakthrough, which we should not rely on either for practical reasons, probability theory, corporate management theory, you name it, strategic management, we should not rely on it. And even if it were going to happen, I don't think we should actually personally for intrinsic value reasons. But it's hugely unlikely to happen to that extent. In which case, we have to put the technology aside and review and re-evaluate our personal human values to a point that is more akin to the sustainability imperative. I got researchers in Parliament to find out the extent to which the UN projections factor in environmental constraints along the lines of ecological footprint that we have discovered in the last 20 years. The answer is not at all. They're just simply statistical mortality and fertility projections. There is no value issue that goes into it in terms of sustainability. So, I should stop. Uncertainty in the species. We are engaging in genetic self-determination. We are obviously promoting, in fact, am I right, the first womb transplant. It's either just occurred or about to occur. The first head transplant is on its way in China by an Italian surgeon. But that takes us back to Barnard. We will remember Barnard in the 1960s. The first heart transplant took our breath away, literally, in one case. He survived for a while. We're doing this. And we are genetically, the genome project, we are engaging in conscious self-determination of ourselves as a species. Icarus flying high. And unleashing artificial intelligence in a way that makes some of us question the relationship between human intelligence and artificial intelligence. And a few people that I've quoted in the paper have a few things to say about that. But the good news is that UN is riding to the rescue in the form of the International Academy of Astronautics with its Declaration of Principles, which are actually extremely interesting and worth reading, and the UNESCO World Health Assembly and the UN General Assembly on both genetic self-determination and also artificial intelligence, which of course takes its form in the form of drones with UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, which can scare the daylights out of an Air New Zealand plane coming into land at 26,000 feet just out of Auckland the other day, and can do other things as well in Gaza and Afghanistan. And laws. Laws is the new UAVs. Laws is lethal autonomous weapons systems, where it isn't just a drone being manipulated by a laptop at a Las Vegas swimming pool. It is that decision. The whole contained circuit of decision making of whether to kill a human or not is automated. So laws is now entering the realm of UN negotiations for international law struggling to keep up with technological improvement. Most of this occurring in Geneva. And uncertainty in the cosmos. But I'll, having taken sufficient flight to 26,000 feet, I'll gently come to land by just saying that for me, 21st century cosmology is my search for God. And that does not deracinate the concept to a point where it has no human anthropocentric meaning necessarily. It can be undertaken because of the infinite sense of wonder that modern physics is imparting to us, in my humble view, is akin to the infinite sense of wonder that Abraham had and my wife Marilyn and I had in the middle of the Jordan Desert and overnight in a sleeping bag in 2001 for the Leonid meteorite shower. Of the infinite wonder of the universe out there. And for that matter, on Waiheke Island, looking at the Milky Way every night. The search for a theory of everything in which the classical model of cosmology and the classical model of physics are struggling. And what I've been saying about legal and political institutions coming together to address our mortal problems on this coil is simply a small anthropocentric metaphor for what is going on inside the human mind in bringing the standard model of cosmology and the standard model of particle physics together so that we end up with a theory of everything, which is no longer a slogan, but is a purposeful project and exploit by the greatest minds we have. And so when I explore that with my wife at night to get to sleep, literally, 5.5 grandchildren, is the nearest thing to emotional and spiritual insight, providing a kind of sense of security of us in the cosmos, just on the shores of that ocean of knowledge that are still lapping at our feet. Best summed up in Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5.
Please, could I ask, with all the information and hype we hear about climate change, shouldn't we be hearing equal amount about population control?
Yes.
Why are we not?
Because for the politicians, not just in the New Zealand Parliament, but all 45,000 of us around the world, it's in the too hard basket. and politicians don't like hard baskets. Climate change, because it gets down to individual moral choice, size of family. Ann Tolley waded into it last week. My party is the only party that has a population policy as such. We consider ourselves brave, but we mutter a bit about the details. I risk myself by talking about if you use the ecological footprint metric and the overshoot, which would take you strictly from 7.2 to 4.8 right now, that's dangerous. I was at the Cairo UN Population Conference in 1994. Those were brave days when in 92 in Rio we adopted the Climate Change Framework Convention in 92 at Rio and the Biodiversity Framework Convention in 92, and then went on to the Population Conference in 94, 2 years later, and they were closely related in theory. But we did not emerge with a framework convention on population. The forces like Georgia or blacks, the forces ranged from, and they're interesting bedfellows, of the Vatican, the United States, and the Arab countries out here, wanting no constraints on moral choice, to over here in Malaysia, and over here, Nordics, West Europeans, Nordics, Japan, New Zealand, kind of, and a debate in the center. And there was a declaration that emerged, actually, which wasn't a bad declaration. In fact, you could argue that in diplomatic terms, it was more than half full. It was a program of action which emphasized two things. Education of the girl child, so that 5.2 comes down to 2.1, fertility, and reproductive and resources, sufficient resources for reproductive clinics, population planning clinics. All of this in the context of population planning. China, of course, sitting out there, being vilified, and now arguing with the greater freedom that their power allows themselves to now, that they did the right thing, even though they acknowledge individual suffering. So you trade off between short-term individual suffering, if you like, without wanting to brutalize this, to long-term societal foresight. Totally agree. I totally agree. We need that.
Thank you. I think that's the one long question. So I would like to thank Kennedy Graham. If you remember yesterday, Lloyd left us with the question about what is going to be the successor to the United Nations, what's going to bring about a world government. And it's a vacuum in the thinking of many of us about political power and international governance. You've talked to us about the political and legal activities that are going on at a worldwide level, and even the military briefly. I enjoyed your little vignette there. Thank you very much. I first heard about the acronym LAWS here today, and that might be the same for all of you. It's absolutely terrifying. I hate it. Change is upon us faster than we can think about. Kennedy, you've spoken to us from your knowledge and your experience, but also and particularly from your heart. We're now going to go off and talk about what you've talked about in the context of where we're coming from, and I'd like to thank you very much. Would you join me in thanking you?